Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Well, who better to turn to than a former naval intelligence officer for an assessment on some of the really important challenges that we're facing in terms of our national security at the moment. She is J.E. Dyer. She writes these days at libertyunyielding.com, where you can find her as the optimistic conservator working for domestic tranquility and world peace. These seem to be worthy objectives. J.E., it's good to have you with us. Thank you for your writings on so many interesting topics. We're anxious to explore them with you for the first time. Welcome.
Super. Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, listen, I thought I'd start with something that you called attention to the other day, this so-called echo chamber that Ben Rhodes and some of the other former Obama foreign policy and other apparatchiks seem to be engaged in at the moment with the fairly, well, I think, declared purpose of trying to stop Donald Trump. Who are these characters and what do you make of what they're up to?
Well, Ben Rhodes and his co-founder, Ben Rhodes was on Obama's National Security Council. He was one of Obama's special assistants and a chief architect behind the campaign to secure the Iran deal.
Which, as I recall, he declared involved in the New York Times Magazine, no less, an echo chamber. Now, are they actually caviling about people calling it that?
Well, that's exactly right, yes. And now they're accusing the Trump administration of harboring a conspiracy theory by referring to what they're doing now as creating an echo chamber against Trump. But his co-founder is Jake Sullivan, who is a longtime Democratic operative and worked for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 campaign. And then Colin Kahl was an advisor to Joe Biden, also a senior foreign policy guy, who is now on the board of National Security Action, the nonprofit that Ben Rhodes founded.
Yeah, the sort of epicenter of the echo chamber, as I understand it.
That's exactly right. And the intention of it is to fight back against Trump's foreign policy, to undermine it and take it down.
Yeah. Well, and we saw Ben Rhodes' hand at work when, in that earlier episode, as you say, when he was in office, he used the National Security Council to feed willing but generally naive journalists. I think, as I recall, he was somewhat disparaging of them, as a matter of fact, as know-nothings or something of the kind. And this evidently is part and parcel of what he and his friends are up to now for the purpose of not just challenging but subverting this president's foreign and defense policy. It seems, J.E. Dyer, that they're not exactly alone in this enterprise. Talk to us a little bit about some of your reflections on what the Mueller investigation is up to, the witch hunt, as the president's called it, that has yet to turn up any witches.
One thing that is very clear about the Mueller investigation and where it came from is that it was never really about anything that Trump or his associates had done. It appears to have been launched from separate motives other than that. I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago discussing that and how the implication about Bruce Orr and his role in moving information from Christopher Steele, the dossier author, over to the FBI, even after Steele had become had been dismissed as an informant for the FBI, shows that there's a thread on this going back to substantially before there were any allegations to be made about the Trump campaign.
And you've pointed out, as I recall, that John Brennan's role in engineering that is a non-trivial one. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, he was shopping the idea to the Obama administration and even on Capitol Hill well before it ever came out to the public.
Speaking of Capitol Hill, I did want to ask you again, J.E., as a former intelligence officer yourself, what you make of the House IT scandal, as it's come to be called for shorthand, involving, by some estimates, fully a one-fifth of the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives, who seemingly thought it a good idea to have a ring of Pakistani nationals providing their information technology services. As a matter of a tradecraft, what do you make of all of that?
Well, it's just absolutely extraordinary. It's hard to account for in any normal fashion, for one thing, because none of the Pakistani individuals involved had an IT background. One of them, at least, was his resume had him as a worker at McDonald's before he was hired on Capitol Hill. And they have also been come under extraordinary protection from the Democrats on Capitol Hill. Quite remarkable that the Awans, the Pakistanis, have been involved in a lot of seemingly petty money laundering, a lot of it very similar to what Hezbollah was found to have been doing in the DEA investigation that was under Project Cassandra.
Yeah, aborted.
Aborted, that's right, by Bruce Orr, incidentally. According to a DEA agent named Derek Maltz, it was Bruce Orr who basically was the one who quashed the vigorous prosecution of what Hezbollah had been doing.
Bruce Orr, of course, of Justice Department fame and now implicated in some of the stuff we were just talking about a moment ago in terms of the dossiers, movement around, and undermining the president. But just to stay with the Imran Awan story for a moment, you raised the question, as have we, about what on earth the Justice Department and the federal judge were doing when essentially, I'm not even sure you could call it a slap on the wrist, what they meted out in the way of punishment for Imran Awan, the ringleader here in this IT network. And just quickly, do you have any suspicions, J.E., perhaps informed by your experience, that they were being run or at least helping Pakistani intelligence?
Absolutely. Luke Rosiak, you mentioned him before, the Daily Caller journalist, has written on a number of occasions about the links that they still have, very strong links, including family and clan links, to the intelligence service back in Pakistan.
J.E., there's so much more to talk with you about. I hope we'll have a chance to do so again in the near future. In the meantime, I appreciate tremendously what you're doing at libertyunyielding.com. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we will speak with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, about the Mueller investigation, North Korea, the border, and more, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we have in the House virtually Robert Charles, a former Assistant Secretary of State involved with our border security issues and countering narcotics back in the George W. Bush administration. He has been involved in a number of other important public policy and national security roles over the years, however, including serving as a naval intelligence officer, as did our previous guest, J.E. Dyer. Also in the Reagan and Bush White Houses, he has taught cybersecurity, among other things, and cyber law at Harvard University. He is a man in short of many parts, not least of which is the author of a wonderful new book, Eagles and Evergreens. Robert Charles, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's always great to be with you. And I'll tell you, at the very first book signing, our book sold out. So Eagles and Evergreens is out there on Amazon, and I'd love to see people give it a shot.
Well done. Well, and I encourage people to take a listen to the podcast of our hour-long interview on the subject. It was really inspiring, and I commend you for both getting it done and visiting with us from time to time about your insights. Let me ask you, speaking of insights, we have had an uptick, I think it's fair to say, in terms of concern about what we're doing with border security and more generally the enforcement of our immigration laws in the context of the 2018 election. The president is focused like a laser beam, it seems, on trying to get the wall built. Democrats seem equally determined not to let that happen. This episode in Iowa, no border state that, but it turns out we're all in border states now. Molly Tibbetts was murdered, it appears, by an illegal alien. Give us your take on insights that should be drawn from this particular episode and more broadly, based on your experience, the significance of leaving the border insecure and allowing such people free rein in our country.
Now, Frank, you're exactly right. This is an event with layers of significance for the average American. And you said something a moment ago that reminds me of when John Kennedy went to Berlin and said, Ich bin ein Berliner, which, of course, is not appropriate German. But the point was, we're all one now. And in reality here, we are all Americans. When it comes to the protection of our borders, we have to be. It is unfathomable to me that we are at a point in time when, as you said a moment ago, basically, every state is a border state because these illegal aliens have penetrated so much of the country. Let me give you four or five really significant points. First, as Venezuela deteriorates, I was told by people at the State Department that it is really threatening to become the Syria of this hemisphere, which is to say, if it disgorges another, I think it has already disgorged a million refugees to surrounding countries. If those refugees head this way, we have a bigger problem. The relationship with Mexico must become more of a priority. Jeff Sessions is right about sanctuary cities. And when you get right down to the Molly Tibbetts issue, what it boils down to is every American, and I don't really care what their party is, has to say the sovereignty of this country and the public safety of individuals and communities around this country has to be paramount. We have to think about it as a number one issue. I will tell you that as you unpack illegal immigration, and certainly the Molly Tibbetts, the sad Molly Tibbetts case is emblematic again of why every American should care. But as you unpack that, it gets to be a bigger and bigger problem. We are now facing the largest production of coca in Colombia, and that means the largest transshipment. The commandants of the Coast Guard, successive recent ones, would tell you the trend line is all up. We are seeing a dramatic uptick in cocaine in this country. We're seeing a dramatic uptick in heroin in this country. We're seeing a dramatic uptick at the border as these traffickers bring in everything from fentanyl to other synthetics, including an uptick right now in methamphetamine. And of course, marijuana has become such a big, really, it's an extraordinary failure of policy that we're legalizing that drug because it's now being transshipped in both directions on the border. So we're now, Colorado's becoming a transshipment country in effect. So when you get right down to it, illegal immigration isn't just about an individual case or an individual city or five or six states. It is about the fact that the United States of America and the integrity of citizenship, the integrity of our borders is really at risk. And no individual, back to the World War II generation, certainly any years before that, would ever advance the idea that we should be unprotective of our borders. I really do. No matter what empathy you have in your heart for human beings, I find it shocking that there are Democrat candidates out there that are willing to walk away from the integrity of citizenship and the integrity of our borders. It is essential to public safety. It is essential to America.
Yeah. Speaking of public safety, this is, let me pivot to more removed threats, though they have the capacity to be very much present in our own country, in part thanks to the porousness of our borders and the lack of interior enforcement. I'm thinking particularly of the nation of Iran at the moment, and wanted to get your thoughts on what's happening, Robert Charles, in the Strait of Hormuz at the moment that could have very far-reaching implications for our own energy prices, to say nothing of a lot of dislocation as those paid by others skyrocket should the strait be closed to shipping of oil. How serious a threat do you regard that to be, drawing on your experience as naval intelligence officer, perhaps among other things, and what should we be doing about it?
I think Iran is a serious concern, and this business recently about not only firing ballistic missiles in and around the strait, but publicly saying that they're considering swarming and shutting down the strait is an enormous call for deterrence. I think unfortunately what it means is that we're going to have to go back and create perhaps a greater level of deterrence to make clear that we don't tolerate that. The Saudis can't tolerate that. Anybody who uses the Strait of Hormuz cannot tolerate that. And, I think that people need to just kind of put this in the back of their mind. We're talking about an area that's about 20 miles across, maybe 21 miles across. It is an area that contains within it roughly 4 miles of shipping lanes. The notion that any one country, never mind a rogue country that has really been the quintessential bad actor on the international stage, would try to shut that down, it's not a declaration of war, but it is clearly a declaration of interference with international trade. Oil prices could rise. I'm not an oil trader and I'm not an oil analyst, but realistically, although the United States, again, this comes back to the very core values that this president and his administration have been pushing, that we should be more self-reliant on oil, that we should be more attentive to Iran. We should not, as John Kerry and Hillary Clinton and President Obama did, somehow treat Iran as a normal nation state. They are not a normal nation state. They do not live up to their promises, and the promises they make are, as the old saying goes, their pie crust promises, easily made and easily broken. And the problem we've got right now is that Iran is, again, testing and probing and trying to push the security envelope. And again, this is where the big boys have to come in. And we are I don't like thinking of us as the policemen of the world, but we are the moral and we are the physical reminder to many of these countries that there are international norms. They're actually timeless. They're consistent with not only international law, but I would even say natural law. You don't interfere in the basic human prerogatives, and oil happens to be right now a very important aspect of energy generation globally. You don't interfere in that and expect to just get away with it. And so, again, we have to be the guidepost for the world. And frankly, in the Obama era, we were not. And now, again, we are.
Fascinating topic, and one that has so many different elements to it. As you've mentioned deterrence, you've mentioned our allies in that part of the world, you've mentioned the relative ease with which that critical outlet of the strait from the Persian Gulf into the Arabian Sea could be severed. It's a prime challenge, and I hope that our naval forces and other national policy makers are up to it. Let me ask you about Hezbollah. There has been talk for a long time about this terrorist group that is essentially a proxy of Iran having cells inside our country. Without getting into any classified information, how serious a threat do you regard that to be, at whatever moment the Iranian government sees fit, those cells could be activated to engage in violence here inside the United States itself?
I think, Frank, the best way to answer that question is to sort of move from an outer circle to an inner circle. Globally, Hezbollah, there's no question, Hezbollah is, it's not essentially, it's truly an extension of the Iranian state. They clearly are an FTO, a foreign terrorist organization. They make, in many ways, no bones about it. They are active in this hemisphere. They have been active in the tri-border region. They've been active at times in Central America. They've been active at times in the Caribbean. There's also no doubt that they have the intent of disruption. Americans, we tend to think of ourselves as isolated and somehow secure with oceans on both sides and, historically borders at top and bottom. And reality is we're not isolated. We are very vulnerable, as we always have been, to the potential for interference by terrorist organizations. This is one other reason, by the way, whether or not you get down, you know, getting down to brass tacks about exactly who's in this country. I think DHS works very hard, as does DOJ, DOD, and the intelligence community to make sure that we do not allow either sleeper cells or any cell of that kind to mature and never mind metastasize in this country. But I have to tell you, this goes back to your border question a minute ago. If you ask any Border Patrol official who has been on that border, if you even ask those that are sort of in the second and third rings of understanding about the border, but they see the data, they would tell you that there is always and has been an elevating threat of terrorist organizations trying to penetrate the United States. Hezbollah happens to be one of the largest, if not the largest in the world, and it happens to be heavily drug funded.
This is a topic, whether it's the enemies, foreign or domestic, that requires our close attention. And we're so appreciative of what you give to it, among other places, at Fox News and foxnews.com. And for joining us from time to time, I hope you do so again in the near future. In the meantime, have a good Labor Day holiday, and we'll talk with you again soon. Next up, Sean Bigley joins us from straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Gordon Chang, one of America's, well, duty experts is the way I think of him, a national treasurer as well, on matters involving Asia. He is particularly mindful, of course, about the economic and national security implications of what is happening there for our security as well as our prosperity. He is the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. You can find his writings at The Daily Beast, among other places, National Interest. He is also frequently seen on Fox, among other outlets. I'm interested in the latest, as you see it, Gordon, in terms of this so-called trade war with China. As we've been discussing now for quite some time, there's a lot more to it than just trade, of course. But talk, if you would, about the meetings that were held with David Malpass, the Undersecretary of Treasury, last week, with a Chinese delegation, and where you think things are going.
Well, this time, the dispute between the United States and China, which we call a trade war, but which is really a tech war, clearly is going to go on for a long time. It's not just months, as some people think. It could be years, even longer than that. Hmm. The Chinese have been stealing U.S. intellectual property to the tune of billions of dollars a year. And that's why President Trump has imposed tariffs under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. It's to stop the Chinese from stealing and to stop the Chinese from force taking of U.S. IP. And we need to do this because we have an innovation-based economy. The Chinese, they're willing to make certain concessions, but they're not the concessions that go to the core of our dispute with China. For instance, intellectual property theft, industrial policies, subsidies for state enterprises. So this is going to go on for a long time. This is where we determine the future of our country, Frank, and we cannot afford to compromise anymore.
I couldn't agree with you more, Gordon. I'm interested in some of your insights into the thinking going on in China about all this that impels it to be protracted and perhaps even, as you described it, an existential challenge, as the Chinese see it. You've also mentioned, Gordon, in some of your writings that the Chinese seem, over the period in which President Trump has been ratcheting up the pressure on them, to have gone from arrogance to anxiety about what's afoot here. Explore with us sort of the thinking as you understand it in Beijing at the moment, and again, what it portends.
During the campaign in 2016, the Chinese thought that they could control Trump as president. And in the first months of the Trump administration, I think that they were actually even more confident, as President talked about his good friend Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler. But what President Trump did, as he saw that Beijing was not cooperating on a number of issues, including North Korea, is President Trump decided that this was enough. And so he did start to impose tariffs on the Chinese, and he started to take positions which undermined China's view in the world. So Right now, you are seeing many people in the Chinese political system, Chinese academics and analysts and observers are starting to understand they cannot win a long-term struggle with the United States, and they're blaming Xi Jinping for starting it. And so there right now is a lot of turbulence in the Chinese political system. Xi Jinping is probably secure, but as this contest drags on, I think that his position could erode further. And that's why there's a lot of anxiety right now in China over its relations with the United States. You know, in the U.S., we had this controversy over who lost China in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Well, what we're seeing in Beijing right now is who lost America.
Gordon, you've raised an interesting point, and I've been mulling it myself, so I'm anxious to get your thoughts on it. The president has not, to my knowledge, stopped saying how much he thinks of Xi Jinping and how good a friend he is and how much he admires what he's doing. And yet the actions are very different. How is the president's attitude towards the president of China at the moment being perceived? And is it, as you've intimated here, actually contributing to internal dissent within China about him and his leadership?
President Trump's comments about Xi Jinping are puzzling. I mean, also, we got to view them in context because Trump, even though he's taking a very different posture on North Korea over the weekend on Friday, when he stopped Pompeo from going to Pyongyang, President Trump still talks about his great friendship with Kim Jong-un. And, of course, his comments about Putin are legendary. But if you look at the substance of American policy, as you point out, not only with regard to Russia and North Korea, but also with China, they are very different. You know, previous presidents, Republicans, Democrats, for decades took the view that it was in our interest to support the Communist Party of China. You look at what President Trump is doing, that's not American policy anymore. And he was very clear about this in a tweet, I believe, at the end of last week, where he said, look, you know, the America had policies that China looked like it was going to take over the world. He said, no longer. And this is important because what he's saying is he's asserting American primacy. Mm-hmm. And this is important for Americans to hear, but more important, it's important for people around the world to hear that the United States will lead again. And this is absolutely critical.
Will not only lead again, but will be looking to its own interests in providing that leadership, which has not always been the case in the past, needless to say. Gordon, you mentioned North Korea, and I did want to ask you about the president's decision as Mike Pompeo was packing his bags to go back to North Korea with this chap Steve Biegun in tow as his new representative, I guess you'd say, to the North Koreans for the purposes of the denuclearization talks. This obviously came as something of a surprise to the Secretary of State. Was it a surprise to you? And more to the point, where do you think this suggests things stand now with respect to the North Korean government and this ambition to denuclearize it?
Well, it certainly was a surprise to me on timing. I think everyone realized that at some point President Trump would pivot and go back to a maximum pressure campaign because the North Koreans were not, in fact, moving to giving up their arsenals. But I thought, and most other people thought as well, that this pivot would take place, you know, later into the year, maybe after the midterm elections, maybe next year. What President Trump, to his credit, did was he realized that the North Koreans blew it. Remember, President Trump said at that press conference in June in Singapore that he was going to give Kim a one-shot opportunity to do the right thing. Well, Kim has decided not to take advantage of that, and so President Trump has started to change his policy. That's a good thing. I hope to see President Trump start to put more pressure on the North Koreans, but more important than that, to put pressure on the Chinese and the Russians and the South Koreans, mm-hmm. who have decided that it was open season on sanctions. We let up pressure on sanctions. I don't think we should have done that, but we did it. That was to create this good mood and environment for talks with North Korea. And so the Russians and the Chinese and the South Koreans thought that they could do what they want. Mm-hmm. Now I think they're probably reassessing that because it looks like American policy is going back to what made it successful up to May, and that is pressure.
Let's talk a bit about South Korea. Gordon, you have been raising an alarm about what the South Korean President Moon Jae-in is up to, specifically beyond easing up on sanctions and otherwise it seems reverting to kind of the sunshine policy of the past with respect to propping up the North Korean regime with economic assistance in various forms. Now it seems as though Moon is pushing hard to actually unify the peninsula, which would seem under present circumstances to be a very dangerous thing to do. Talk us through that, if you would.
Yeah. President Moon, who I think is more dangerous to us than Kim Jong-un for a number of reasons, Moon plans to go to Pyongyang next month for the third inter-Korean summit of his presidency. Clearly, he wants to unify the country. He's said so. And, you know, previous presidents of South Korea have said that as well. That's established South Korean policy. What makes Moon different is what Moon is trying to do to push that along. So, for instance, we see moves to decrease South Korea's military readiness. And, for instance, they're taking down guard posts and fencing along the demilitarized zone, which separates the two Koreas. They are reducing the terms of service of conscription, which makes no sense in a society with a declining demography. They plan to severely reduce the size of the South Korean military. And there are photos which suggest that the South Koreans are taking down these tank traps, which are along suspected North Korean invasion routes. One can look at some of these military moves and say that there's some justification for them, but not when you put them all into context. It looks like Moon is just opening the door to North Korea pressure on South Korea to intimidate South Korea into submission. And we have seen that Moon is trying to amend the South Korean constitution to make it more compatible with North Korea's. All of these developments are alarming.
Yeah, needless to say. I've also been told, Gordon Chang, that the South Korean president has populated his government with a variety of people who are very much on the radical end of the pro-North Korea sort of spectrum in his country. I've got to believe that people who aren't are alarmed by some of these things, particularly, as you say, taking them all together. But, you know, you studied this region exhaustively, and you have a feeling for what goes on in the heads of people like Kim Jong-un. Is there any doubt in your mind that these are being perceived by him as signals that his policy, his strategy of efforts to intimidate and to dominate South Korea are paying off and therefore makes even more unlikely the kind of denuclearization that the president had been promised?
It's hard to see into Kim Jong-un's mind, but on this particular question, Frank, I think it's actually easy. Kim has been talking about quote-unquote final victory with some frequency. And that final victory in North Korean lingo is taking over South Korea. So on this question, we know what Kim is thinking because we know what he's saying.
Gordon, we will be following up with you on both of these important stories, China and North Korea, as we do each week. Thank you for joining us. This one, we'll look forward to our next conversation.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Sean Bigley, Esquire. He is a national security attorney and the managing partner of Bigley Rainish LLP. He has been, among other things, a federal background investigator for the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, a professor at the faculty of Chapman University, teaching national security and criminal justice courses. He's an essayist in the Wall Street Journal. He's written for the National Interest, the California Journal of Criminal Law, among other places. And we have had the privilege of visiting with him once, I believe, before, in connection with one of his clients, a man I've come to know and admire greatly, Adam Lovinger. And we're delighted to have him back for an update on the peculiar case of Adam Lovinger, especially against the backdrop of charges by John Brennan and the like of rabid politicization of security clearances and the withdrawal thereof by the Trump administration. Sean Bigley, the irony will not be lost on our listeners as you lay out the case, but thank you for joining us. It's good to have you, and most especially, thank you for what you're doing for a man who has been, I believe, profoundly wronged by our government, who deserves better, Adam Lovinger. We're anxious to hear you tell the story. Welcome back.
Frank, thanks so much for having me again. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and frankly, one that should appall, I think, all Americans. Just, you know, by way of brief background, Mr. Lovinger spent over a decade serving honorably in the Department of Defense. He's a decorated analyst in the Office of Net Assessment, which is a very secretive internal think tank at the Pentagon. And every year, year after year, consistently outstanding performance evaluations, awards, bonuses, not a blip on the radar, until all of a sudden in fall of 2016, he starts raising issues with a gentleman we now know as the agent provocateur to the Trump campaign, Stefan Halper, as well as a close confidant of Hillary Clinton, both of whom were hired to work as very high paid contractors for this secretive office, ONA. And essentially, Adam's concerns were twofold. Number one, that these folks were being paid egregious amounts of taxpayer dollars to perform what he felt to be very little work, work that was not informing policymakers. And number two, that they were being used in violation of a federal statute that outlines what are and are not inherently governmental functions, specifically that they were being used to conduct foreign relations with allies. And of course, at the time, he had no idea what Mr. Halper was actually up to. He just thought of him as another contractor in the office. And so I think when you look at the case through that prism, it's very clear this is not a political man. This is not a case about politics. This is simply somebody who was trying to do the right thing. And for that, he got burned.
Yeah. And burned in a way that, as I said, is very much relevant to some of the current thrashing that's going on about the politicization or weaponization, as some would have it, of security clearances. Tell us what kind of retribution Adam Lovinger was subjected to by James Baker, the current director of the Office of Net Assessment in the Pentagon and the Washington Headquarters Services.
Sure. I have to start by saying, first of all, that this is a very, very unusual case. And just to put it in context, my firm handles a couple hundred of these cases a year involving folks who have had their security clearances taken away and they're fighting to get them back. And so we have a pretty good bird's eye view of how this process typically plays out. And this has been anything but the norm. Essentially, from day one, they have gone out of their way to rig the process against him to ensure that he is not getting a due process, not getting fundamental fairness. They've done things like leak defamatory and false information about him to the media, really things that I've never seen before from, you know, typically very careful career bureaucrats.
And just to be clear, Sean, there's no question that that's the source of this?
No question whatsoever. And it's a little bit lengthy to get into how we know that, but the bottom line is there's documentary evidence that evidences the fact that these were the folks who were doing this. And you know, it's just essentially they've tried to stack the deck against him from a process standpoint. And we're very confident that we have the facts and the law on our side, but they control the process. And so, you know, this is a theme and something that we've started to see in more cases where you have these bureaucrats who are weaponizing the process. They're using it to keep folks like Mr. Lovinger, who's a very vocal supporter of the president, out of the bureaucracy. And they're doing it in a manner that really destroys people's reputations, that destroys their livelihood. And it's something that really needs to be addressed.
And in Adam Lovinger's case, as I understand it, he was actually not just supporting President Trump, he was working for him in the National Security Council staff detailed over there from the Pentagon when this deal went down with his security clearances, prompting him to be removed from the NSC and essentially remanded to make work or worse in the Pentagon. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So what they did here is they essentially launched an internal quote-unquote investigation, and I use that term very loosely because you know, there are a number of issues there. Among other things, they selected two investigators who were subordinate to Mr. Baker and who had absolutely no legal or investigative training whatsoever to do this job. And they, of course, reached conclusions that were precisely what Mr. Baker, we think, had in mind, in essence, a predetermined finality. And so Mr. Lovinger had already been over at the White House by that point for about 5 months, and they yanked him back. They stripped him of his clearance. They put him out on essentially the bureaucratic equivalent of Siberia to do make work for a number of months, and then ultimately revoked his clearance. And now he's sitting at home trying to figure out how to feed his family.
Yeah, this is just an outrage on so many different levels. And I'm gratified that some serious national security journalists have been taking up this cause, notably Rowan Scarborough at the Washington Times and good folks like Richard Pollack at the Daily Caller. The story persists, however, as I understand it. Is there any end in sight to Adam's travails?
Well, the short answer is no. And, you know, one of the real outrages in this process is the extent to which they've dragged it out. You know, they control everything. They hold all the cards. And so they have cut off his paycheck, and yet they continue to drag their feet and delay and obstruct. And this is something, you know, in whistleblower law, we call it the big squeeze, where essentially the agency, Department of Defense in this case, will go to the mat to, you know, ensure that the individual is not getting their due process. They'll drag it out, and then meanwhile, they'll cut off the funding. And so it essentially puts that person in a very untenable position where they have to decide at some point, is it worth continuing to fight?
Yeah. Well, again, we all owe you a debt of gratitude, Sean Bigley, for your willingness to help Mr. Lovinger engage in that fight, despite his impecuniousness at the moment, which, again, is a travesty. The more so because the country needs people like him, among other places, I would argue, in the National Security Council at the moment. And the fact that his clearances have been removed from him makes this whole controversy over John Brennan, who, honestly, I can't figure out how he got a clearance in the first place as a communist voter and a proponent of Sharia supremacism. It's just unbelievable. And yet we're hearing a lot about his difficulties, but nothing about Adams. Let me just ask you, because you've had considerable experience with this, representing some of these people, I gather, and certainly monitoring the situation, Adam Lovinger has, at least relatively speaking, the goods, I'm told, on the people who are perpetrating this outrage. Can you just give us a sense of the numbers or the at least the magnitude of this problem as it relates to others who have been subjected to weaponized, you know, mistreatment by security clearance or withholding of it by Democrats?
Sure. Yeah, you know, you're absolutely correct. I mean, Mr. Lovinger is in a very fortunate position relative to many of his colleagues in that he, unbeknownst to him, had essentially unwittingly stumbled into the deep state's plotting with Mr. Halper to set up the whole Trump-Russia collusion narrative that is, we now know, bunk. But essentially, there are a lot of other folks like him out there who don't have that luxury and who don't have, as you put it, the goods on these folks. And so I see them every day. I represent a number of people in the administration from a very senior level all the way down to a very low staff assistant level folks. They don't have the financial resources to wage this fight. They don't have the visibility that Mr. Lovinger has. And essentially, they get into a position where their options are to walk away and go on to another career or to fight and risk draining their finances and have their reputation smeared.
Thank you. Again, Sean Bigley is the managing partner of Bigley Renish LLP and a national security attorney of renown. Thank you for your time today, sir. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.